From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. The new book, The Charmer, the story of Robert Redlin, rapist, murderer, and millionaire, and the women who fell victim to his allure, by Richard Mudie and Charles Buckley. And I have those gentlemen on the line with me tonight. Richard, Charles, good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to have you. If you could, let's start with Charles. Quick introduction. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a career prosecutor, 27 years in law enforcement as a prosecuting attorney. The last big trial I had was that of Robert Redlin. I was only in for a short time, the last trial over his long career of trials and prosecutions, and I handled his last case and was able to convict him after two prior murder trials were unsuccessful. So then I was assigned to the case because there was an alleged conflict raised by the defense attorneys to try and preclude the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office from prosecuting the murder cases for the third time. So I was assigned up temporarily just to try this case. I later became the acting prosecutor in Bergen County for a two-year period, which I enjoyed very much.
And Richard?
Yes, I'm a former Navy pilot, a former mayor of my hometown, Ramsey, New Jersey, a former businessman, and currently a writer. I also teach American government and politics at a New Jersey university.
Yeah, you know, when we think of serial killers, serial rapists, the types of stories that grab the public, Charles, that grabs their attention and makes them want to learn more. What about this Redlin? Is it that would make the people want to pick up this book and learn about this guy?
Well, Robert Redlin was an especially interesting personality. He was the Charmer is a very appropriate title for the book because that's how it was able to ingratiate himself to so many unsuspecting women. He just had a way of getting close to them so he could overpower them quickly and do whatever he wanted to do. Initially, they were just robberies. It then turned to sexual assaults and rapes, and finally resulting in the two murders. And I think they came about because he decided over the course of his time, whenever he left witnesses, he ended up doing time in jail. And I just think as a matter of he thought for his own well-being, he would just do what he had to do with these women and kill them off. His career over the period of time and the number of things that occurred, the hung juries, the escapes from custody, jumping out the third-story window of the Bergen County Courthouse, having a girlfriend bring a shotgun to the hospital where he had feigned an injury to try and get on Easter Sunday, get some medical treatment, bringing a shotgun there with a plan to blast his way out of state's prison. So there is so much here. The aunt, a multi-million dollar aunt who worshipped him, who he planned to kill her during the trial of that charge, she testified for him saying, "Bobby would never do this to me." She left him $9.8 million. I mean, this woman, he charmed her out of all this money, which later got taken away from him, actually. But it's a story which has so many twists and turns. It's unbelievable that one person over this period of time, the 20 or so years that he was actually involved in criminality, could have accomplished so much for himself.
Richard, not unlike Ted Bundy, the good looks, the affluent upbringing, so to speak, able to charm or sway his victims. What in your investigation into writing this book and we'll talk a little bit about the jurors and everything, made this guy such, and again, keep using the term, the charmer.
He was very intelligent, Dana. He hatched a lot of schemes over subterfuge ruses to get close to the victims. But he was no dummy. In the trial that Charlie prosecuted, he actually represented himself and did a pretty decent job for a layperson. But he had this not only a charming demeanor, but in the courtroom he would have his family seated behind him, supporting him. A very good-looking guy. Out of the first four criminal trials he had during his long career, three of those trials resulted in hung juries. In other words, one or more of the jurors on those trials could not vote to convict this handsome young man with a supportive family. They just couldn't believe he committed these horrendous crimes. And of those four trials, three had to do with very serious criminal offenses against women, sexual assault, rapes, and murder. So there was just this way about him that he had this almost Svengali-like appeal, especially to women, but he also had this appeal with men. When he was finally convicted of a rape and got sent to prison for a prison sentence of up to 30 years, the prison psychologist who took charge of Reldon's case to rehabilitate him as a sex offender got completely fooled by him. He would later admit this 30 years later, but he got completely fooled by him, became his biggest champion, and succeeded in getting him paroled on a vicious rape conviction after serving less than 3 years of a 30-year sentence.
Richard Mutey and Charles Buckley are here. We're talking about the new book, The Charmer. Charles, when you prosecute a case like this, or you come into a prosecution like this, do you worry about the jurors being spellbound by the accused?
Well, by the time I tried it in 1986, he was then 46 years old, he was really on the downside. He had lost a lot of his charm. It was clear to me that the jurors disliked him intensely. Once the case started, once they started hearing the evidence, they turned on him. He tried on a couple of occasions to add a little humor to his questioning. It drew absolutely no response from the jurors. As a matter of fact, the very first witness was the husband of the first murder victim, Jonathan Haynes. And when he finished his testimony, the judge said, "Oh, you're excused, Mr. Haynes." Jonathan Haynes refused to leave the witness stand. He sat on the witness chair and stared at every juror till they made eye contact with him. Every single one. I think there at that then were 14 or 15 jurors still there.
Right.
And he made each of them look him right in the eye. And I think the case was over right then. I mean, they disliked Reldon from that point on. So it was a very interesting event.
Now, in all your years of prosecuting, have you ever had anything like that happen?
No. And, you know, the judge was doing something else. I think he assumed that Haynes was leaving the stand.
Right.
And he turned around, and Haynes is still there. And I think Reldon, because he had fired his attorney, really didn't know how to handle the situation. And I wasn't going to object, so
no.
I just let it play out.
Absolutely. Absolutely not. Let's talk about the victims. Richard, we don't, when we do these interviews, give too much of the book away, but it's so important to talk about the victims and just outline their involvement, I guess the victims' families also.
Susan Haynes was a British nurse. She was over here. She got married in June of 1975 and was over here with her husband, who worked for British Leyland Motors. He was an engineer with British Leyland Motors. And she lived in Haworth, New Jersey, an upscale, wonderful town, quiet, low crime rate type of town. And she was looking for a job in her nursing profession. And on the day that she was abducted by Reldon, she was out job hunting, driving home. Reldon followed her home. He had been getting some work done on his car. Just saw her at random. That was his method of choosing his victims, just at random. Something would come over him as he saw a woman alone in a vulnerable type of situation. And he followed Susan Haynes home, saw her drive into her secluded driveway. She went into the house. He drove up and down the street a couple of times and then went into the driveway and probably used some sort of subterfuge to get her close to him so that he could gain physical control over her. He threw her in the back seat of his car, drove off with her, and she was never seen again alive. Her body was not found for at least 3 weeks after that. But within 8 days of her abduction, she was abducted on October 6, 1975. On October 14, 1975, a young girl, 22-year-old Susan Reeve, fresh out of college, working in New York City, got off a commuter bus in her hometown of Demarest, New Jersey, and was walking home. Reldon was coming from a odd job, painting contracting job that he had, saw her walking along the street alone, swerved out and followed her. We had witnesses along the way who saw him follow her and eventually abducted her on that short walk that she had to her home. She went missing, and the entire Northern Valley region of Bergen County, that's in northern New Jersey, was astounded that these two young women were missing. Their bodies hadn't been found. Two young women abducted. It created quite a frenzy. The fact that they were both named Susan also seemed to make people fearful, especially people with that same name. Didn't know if a maniac was out there stalking people named Susan. In any event, their bodies were found toward the end of October. First, Susan Haynes' body was found. She was nude and had been strangled with her own pantyhose. Her body was found in a wooded area in New York State, upstate New York, not far from the New Jersey border. And the very next day, in a different spot, the body of Susan Reeve was found, also nude, also strangled with her pantyhose.
If you're interested in The Charmer, click on the show notes. There's a link to Amazon. I'm sure you can go to any of your bookstores and pick it up there. Charles, when you look at a case that's, you know, the forensics, let's say, going back all those years compared to today, obviously different. How do you take a case like this with Reldon and take it and sell it, I guess, to the jury, or did Reldon do a good enough job hanging himself?
Well, I think it's interesting that in, say, for instance, the initial trial of the rape case, which happened in 1967, they didn't have the advanced techniques that they have now in terms of identifying semen and things of that nature. And the first trial, despite the fact there was a positive identification by the victim, and then by a passing teenager who saw the car and gave a very specific identification of Reldon's car. I mean, it's Robert Reldon's car parked right in front of the house, and he identified it, and there was nobody confronted him on that identification. But for some reason, the jury decided they just couldn't convict them. There was a hung jury, whatever caused it, whether it was the fact of Reldon's family and his personality or because of a lack of evidence at that time of the scientific nature, had to be tried a second time before another judge with another prosecutor was a conviction. And that happened continually with Robert Reldon, that the evidence, the availability to specifically prove through scientific means that he was the one involved, that always was a little bit of a problem. We did find that initially the hair evidence in his car, there was hair samples which the FBI related to both Susan Haynes and Susan Reeve. They at that time they couldn't say these are the hair from each of these individuals. They could say the characteristics are all the same. But in the first two trials, the court had ruled that out. A change in the law had come to pass, by the time I tried the case in 1986. The first two trials were in 1979. I tried it in 1986, and the law had changed, and we got the courts to reverse that ruling. And now with this hair evidence, I mean, the evidence which had been accumulated added to this, added to the fact of his jumping out the window of the courthouse to try and escape, which the courts allowed me to put in as proof of consciousness of guilt. All those things combined, plus his advanced age, his lack of ability to personalize himself out to the jury, he never had a chance, I don't believe, in that case. But it was the advent or the growth of the types of scientific evidence which really put the final nail in the coffin.
The book, The Charmer, we're talking about tonight with the authors Richard Mutie and Charles Buckley. Richard, when the case is going on, Reldon's aunt passes away and she leaves him a couple of dollars to hire a lawyer. What happened?
Well, Reldon is convicted after Charlie's case, and I might add, Dana, that Charlie did a masterful job of prosecuting that case. I wasn't there. I didn't see it, but I read the transcript of every single word of testimony, every single word of argument, and he did a great job. It's really a primer for anyone who enjoys courtroom dramas. He did a great job. In any event, he's convicted. He loses out on his appeals, and he's serving life plus 30 years for these two convictions. There was no death penalty in New Jersey at the time these murders were convicted. His aunt, Lillian Booth, married well. She was, an aspiring actress in the 1950s, and she met an older gentleman by the name of Ferris Booth, whose father was an early investor in IBM. And she married Ferris Booth. He took a liking to her, and they had a wonderful marriage. He died, after 12 years of marriage and left her $50 million. This was in the mid-1950s when he died. In any event, she invested that money well, and as she got on in years neared her death, she had given away millions of dollars to various philanthropies, churches, hospitals, all sorts of charities. She built a wing at Columbia University, her husband's alma mater. In any event, she had accumulated a fortune of $200 million by the time she died in 2007. And in her will, when her will was read, lo and behold, Robert Reldon was on tap to receive a trust fund of about $9 million that she had set up, and that would go to him. And he obviously was very desirous of getting out on parole. He was advanced in years now. He was in his late 60s, rather, when his aunt died. And was able to hire really good lawyers to advance his parole eligibility, perhaps win him a parole, arguing that he was no longer a threat to society. Arthur Reeve, the father of the second murder victim, got wind of this inheritance and resolved to do all in his power to deny these funds to Robert Reldon, so that he could not use those funds to win his freedom. And after a very courageous legal battle with some excellent legal help, he was able to get a judgment against Reldon for $10 million, effectively denying him these funds. And Arthur Reeve, a former attorney, retired attorney, and he's an older gentleman now, he's in his 80s, he's still alive and very alert, but he donated all of the proceeds from his lawsuit victory to a scholarship fund in memory of his daughter at his daughter's alma mater.
Wow. The book is The Charmer. Charles, when you look at all the years you prosecuted, in particular this case, and compare it a little bit to the high profile cases that we see today, the newspaper and the TV coverage and the cable news and all that sort of stuff wasn't around when, so to speak, until, you know, the big cases were covered, were like OJ. The jury system has taken quite a beating here in the last little while. Casey Anthony, for example. Talk about the juries and the jury system when you prosecuted, in particular, this guy compared to today. Is it fair what we're hearing today?
Well, I was very fortunate. I mean, I worked for the Division of Criminal Justice, the Attorney General's office, and we didn't try run-of-the-mill cases generally. We organized crime, political corruption, things of that nature. So I had, over the period of years, the 25 years I was actually with criminal justice, I tried many of the high-profile cases. And I was fortunate because these were cases which attracted the attention of the jurors. I mean, they just stayed on top of it. I tried one of the main members of the Genovese crime family in Hudson County. I tried a Superior Court judge in New Jersey who was charged with taking bribes to fix sentences. I tried police officers who were charged with being involved in gambling activities with organized crime. So I had great cases, and I never noticed. I mean, I never had a problem. I was very successful because the cases which I was given to try were of the kind nature of profile, and they were good cases. The jurors generally convicted them. So this case was in effect not even the most interesting case I ever tried. You know, it just the way it works out, it was a great case, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to try it. But I was fortunate because of the nature of the cases I had, that most of my cases were of the nature where there was a lot of public interest in the case, and they were cases which I really enjoyed prosecuting.
Well, I'll give you, Richard, the last word. And I guess my question to you will be, is, and I ask all authors that come on the program the same question. I'm walking through the bookstore, and I see this book, and I pick it up, and I see the mugshot on the front, and it looks interesting. I see a very good referral by Vincent Bugliosi. We all know who he is, a Charles Manson prosecutor. What about this book, Richard, will make me want to pick it up and not put it down?
Well, we give a little synopsis, I guess, of what the contents will be in the preface of the book. And you know, when someone picks up a book in the bookstore, we've all done it, you sort of browse, you look at the cover, it's the cover that attracts you to it, and as you mentioned, we've got on the front cover a very important quote from Vincent Bugliosi, who read a draft of our book and very kindly gave us his endorsement, calling it one of the best examinations of the criminal mind that he's read in a long time. That's something like that coming from the Charles Manson prosecutor and the author of Helter Skelter, I think should be enough to make anyone picking up the book in a bookstore want to purchase it and read that book. But on the back cover, we've got a picture of Arthur and Barbara Reeve, the parents of Susan Reeve, who prosecuted or went through that civil lawsuit against Reldon to deprive him of his inheritance, and we tell a little bit of that story on the back cover and have a very another good endorsement from another best-selling author. But as someone looks at the table of contents and they see some of the quotes, each chapter has a quote from some part of that chapter that gives a little bit of insight as to what someone in the context of that chapter had to say about the book, and we hope that that's enough to intrigue someone to get into it. We are on our book is excerpted on crimemagazine.com, where someone can look at the preface and first two chapters and read them, and if they like it, they can be directed on where to buy it. But we think it presents a very nice package. You have the book there in front of you, Dana, and I'm sure you were attracted to the cover when you first saw it, too.
Absolutely. And, you know,
in addition to that, I just wanted to say, Dana,
sure,
the people will just be amazed at the way he was able to play the system, that this guy was able to convince professionals, criminal professionals in the criminal justice system, that he deserved some consideration. And over and over and over, he would get, he'd have 12 cases before him. They'd take pleas to the two most minor cases and let him walk. It just was incredible how he was able to do this, always being able to afford the absolute best attorneys through the money that his aunt was providing. And people will read this and just say, how could this happen? And please let it have, you know, put us all behind us, and this doesn't happen anymore.
Absolutely. The book is the Charmer, the true story of Robert Reldon, rapist, murderer, and millionaire, and the women who fell victim to his allure. Click on the link in the show notes to pick it up from Amazon. Gentlemen, our time is up. I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
And I'll hold up the Charmer for those of you watching on television. Take a look at it. It's an excellent book. If you like this style of book, and I like that, each chapter, it gives you a little chapter 14. There was no way her Bobby would ever want to harm her. And a little preface underneath the chapter 19. Be careful what you wish for. That scenario could backfire. Interesting book, The Charmer. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with another charmer, but she's a good one. Her name is Blink from Blink on Crime, and we're going to bring her on and talk about Jerry Sandusky and what that guilty verdict, 45 out of 48 counts, means. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. Always a pleasure to have Blink from the crime blog, blinkoncrime.com, our sister blogger on the air. How you doing, kiddo?
I'm well. Good evening, Dana.
I introduced you as the book I just talked about here called The Charmer, about this guy. I introduced you as a charmer, and you are, but you are on the good side, though, right?
I am. Thank you. I heard that, and I appreciated it. Thanks so much.
This guy, I don't know if you've ever seen this book. It's a great book. He reminds me so much of the Bundy case, although not as serial as a serial killer, but a creepy guy for sure. Interesting. Anyway, that's not why I brought you on to talk about some other author's book. I want to talk about Jerry Sandusky, 45 out of 48. That's a pretty good average. That sucker's not coming out of jail for the rest of his days.
No, he is not. He has effectively has a life sentence, and deservedly so. As you know, he started out with, I call it the 52 pickup,
yeah,
which was 52 counts, which dwindled by the time we were at mid-trial down to 48. And it made sense. One of them had to do with the fact that the statute of limitations had expired. And then the other two counts were actually dismissed in something called sua sponte, which is after the hearing, Latin for after the hearing, by the judge, who waited to hear, kind of interesting, because I don't know that I've seen that. I don't know that I've seen a judge say, you guys missed it, but in testimony, victim number four, and I don't want to be graphic on your show,
sure,
but what he was saying was basically what he was being charged with, the testimony did not match the accusation. So he knew going into, Judge Cleland knew going into it that at the end of the day, if the jury were to find him guilty on those two counts, he would have to set that verdict aside, and did not feel it was fair to the jurors to deliberate on something that he already knew did not meet the burden. So that was kind of an interesting twist at the end.
You know, what about the presentation of the case itself? We'll get into, you know, possible appeals and all that other stuff in a bit here. But what about the presentation, prosecution, defense? I hear the prosecution did a great job, and the defense just kind of, you know, what's the old saying? You throw something against the wall and you hope something sticks.
Well, that's an excellent question. And for me, what was extremely interesting was, a lot of people don't realize this, but the defense, Joe Amendola and Carl Rominger, actually attempted to withdraw from this case.
Oh, really? Okay.
On the evening of trial, they sought from the Circuit Court, Superior Court, and I believe the Supreme Court. It was a sealed motion, so most folks were under the impression that they were seeking more time. In the scheme of things, with the amount of accounts that went into this trial, like as an example, if you compare it to, you know, probably the second biggest case in the last 2 years to come to trial. This is to the Casey Anthony trial, if I'm to think of it. I mean, you can throw John Edwards in there a little bit, but certainly that has its not true crime audience as much as a political audience.
Right.
But what was very interesting to me is they, I mean, again, I don't know that I've heard of that. I'm not surprised by it because, in my opinion, the way that, and we'll bring this up, Joe Amendola, the defense attorney for Jerry Sandusky, allowed him to give the Bob Costas interview, which ultimately we were all kind of, you know, gasping with hands over mouth during that interview, and we heard the edited version. And even that was shocking, that any defense attorney would allow that. I mean, rule 101, you never let your client say something you don't already know he's going to say.
Right.
And go ahead.
No, and I was going to get to that in a minute, and that's one of the things they're talking about now as far as appeal goes, is the NBC interview with Costas and the edited version versus the true version, so to speak. Let's talk about that a little bit. What are they meaning by that?
Well, what they mean in terms of the edited version versus the transcript is Jerry Sandusky gave a telephone interview with his client's, excuse me, with his attorney's permission, and it was edited. This was on The Rock with Brian Williams' show. Bob Costas was a special feature. I mean, it was a coup. He was the only one that had this interview, and we don't know who had the editorial, license to edit it. I would be shocked beyond words if Mr. Costas had anything to do with that.
Right.
I really would. If you can tell by the phraseology, I featured it on my site, of the questions that Mr. Costas asked, he knew what he was asking him, and he did. It was extremely well researched, as I've only ever seen him be.
No.
It didn't come in for a couple of reasons. When I say it didn't come in, it means the prosecution, out of the Attorney General of Pennsylvania's office, requested a certified transcript the Friday before the completion of trial, which is appropriate because we all had, as media and press, we all had the released transcript of the actual interview that did not, the parts of which did not air, which, by the way, is only 3 or 4 paragraphs, but my God, in terms of interpretable, those 3 or 4 paragraphs, I can remember when I saw that interview and I read the transcript, I believe the words on my site were, there is not a chance in hell Amendola is going to put him on the stand.
Right, yep.
And he was going to up until the very end. You had asked me, kind of giving a score or an evaluation, if you will, on the defense and the prosecution. The prosecution, headed up by Linda Kelly, but of course the chief under her would be Joe McGettigan, did a masterful job in what is probably, as a juror or a prosecutor, one of the most difficult cases. We're talking 8 witnesses that had to describe and then be open to cross-examination of sexual abuse, rape, as little boys. And it was graphic. In one case, there was, there might have been 2 moms, but in one case there was a mother who was brought on, and the reason that came out was because, to be honest, it was evident that it was possible that there was going to be, the defense was going to try to impeach these gentlemen.
Right.
Letters written by Jerry Sandusky in his own hand. Creepy does not even begin to describe, as a clinician, if I were looking at those letters, it was clear as a bell that this gentleman was a pedophile. He was manipulative. He was exhibiting ritualistic behavior. And he was trying to manipulate so that he was not, to secret his crime.
Yeah. No, exactly. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We're talking the Sandusky case and the verdict. When you hear this and you see the case, let's talk about Sandusky's wife a little bit, getting on the stand and saying, not in my house, you know, the old Tammy Wynette stand by your man persona. Maybe I'm too old to be bringing that up. Maybe nobody knows who Tammy Wynette is. But her standing by your man didn't get him very far.
It did not. Thanks for not asking me to sing a few bars on that, because I know it.
Yeah, okay. All right.
But seriously, you know, you don't hear me say many things in an absolute fashion when I haven't interviewed the witness, but I'm going to say this.
Right.
Dottie Sandusky knew what was going on. There isn't any doubt in my mind. I would not be surprised at some point. You know, keep in mind, Dana, there's a federal grand jury right now that is meeting, and we don't know the extent of their investigation or what they're looking to prove in terms of an indictment. I don't believe this is done.
No.
If you recall, Jerry Sandusky, the whole reason the fourth and final grand jury met on the instant matter was because his phone number came up in a cross-reference check in a ongoing drug investigation involving Penn State. So we don't even know what the net of that is. But I can pretty much tell you that it had to do with Jerry securing what I believe was pot for a victim. And that testimony did not come into trial. So you can betcha that testimony, which, by the way, would have had to have been in the original subpoenas, right?
Right.
Because that's how they caught the guy. That exists somewhere. So I have to believe that potentially, I mean, there's certainly not going to be anything worse than a pedophile, you know, being in place since 1976/1977, you know, at best that we know about. There's nothing in the free world worse than that, really.
No.
But what I can say is this is not over.
No.
You have Tim Curley, you have Schultz facing trial, I want to say July 11th, on the perjury charges and the failure to report. You have a federal investigation also for a violation of the Clery Act. And then you have the NCAA, who is investigating, you know, appropriately, because part of their bylaws and part of their qualification systems and protocols involve, you know, things that are in place. For instance, somebody that was accused of a sex crime having keys to the Lash Building in an emeritus status would not qualify as appropriate or under the bylaws for the money or qualification to be a participant in the NCAA. This is just, you know, it's like they're all under, you know, you recall Wizard of Oz.
Sure, yep.
Pay no attention to the man behind the green curtain. Except this is like, you know, the Bureau of Trust. This is like, you know, the executive administrators. Graham Spanier, the former president who was fired prior to Rodney Erickson, along with Coach Joe Paterno, is now suing Penn State in order to access emails that were found after the fact discussing Jerry Sandusky.
Oh, Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Let's just turn aside from the trial for a minute and talk about this. Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess some of the criticism that we've seen of the media and others with the sports mentality, the big sports team, the big coach. There's a couple of kids that made an allegation. It's not that big of a deal type of thought that was out there and still out there today. Some sportscasters who need their rumps kicked from here to the moon that are actually making fun of this story. This is one sick puppy. He should have been incarcerated a long, long time ago. Let's talk about that sports, let's I'm not sure how to put it. This that sports bulletproof vest, so to speak, the big team, the big town, leave us alone.
Well, I will tell you this. In the interest of full disclosure, I've been on that campus. I've been a student. I have a family member that was offered, who is a all-state national volleyball player, who was offered a full scholarship in her sophomore year. So I know that. I know that campus well. I know that community well. And there isn't anybody that was probably more shocked than I was. Jopa was actually, my niece passed away from Ewing sarcoma about 7 years ago, and there's a picture of Jopa and she on her website, and he was an integral part of her life, of the community. He's very well revered. And to that end, what I want to say is because it's because of that, Dana, that I think this was so non-palatable to people, because it is true that they, you know, people fused the issue with Sandusky with somebody who in center, you know, in Center County, in, you know, Beaver Valley, Happy Valley, Jopa is somewhat of, you know, a godlike figure.
Right.
And so I think people were of the opinion, you know, well, if he knew about it and didn't do more, then it couldn't be true. Right?
Right.
What I want to say to those people is, you know, before he passed, he himself said, I could have done more. That's
right.
A quote.
Yep.
And it wasn't because, you know, we're all fallible. I just believe, let me say it a different way. I'll never believe in my heart of hearts that he himself understood the dark occurrences that Mike McQueary believed he saw.
Right.
And out of Mike's own mouth, he said, what I saw, I didn't necessarily articulate, you know, in a way that was plain, right? In other words, he didn't say, I saw this child being anally raped to Jopa.
Right.
He couldn't bring himself to do it. He was honest, okay? Now, do I think Jopa should get a pass? I don't. I think he could have done more. I think he attended, you know, fundraising events. I think he should have made sure that Jerry Sandusky did not have, you know, any access, that he was prosecuted. Do I think all those things? Yes. But I don't believe that Jopa grasped the concept that a man could be sexually attracted to a young boy. I don't think he ever got there in his mind. I don't.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. You're right. This story is far from over. The potential of other victims, including a son or stepson, whatever, we'll get into that in a minute, is there. What about the other victims? What about them now not coming forward because they think it's all over, he's in jail, it's done, it's not worthwhile for them to come forward? That's just wrong. Where do you think this will go?
If there were people that were not going to come forward as a result of this, that they're not going to come forward.
Right.
I don't think that at this juncture, you know, perhaps in their, if they're in need of reconciliation for this, which of course I would think they would, maybe this is enough. Maybe other people deal with it more privately. I can't imagine the burden that they must bear.
Yep.
What I would say to them is that why it's important that they come forward is because, and this is my biggest issue with this entire mess, is that since 1977, Jerry Sandusky has lured, groomed, and sexually molested young boys. He created an agency, a multi-million dollar agency, to do just that. Make no mistake about it. This man, sole intent, no matter what you say about, oh, well, there was girls that were also, you know, part of the second mile that were never molested, Mr. Sandusky is an advanced narcissist. He is now, he was, diagnostically, he was a pedophile. Today, he's a child molester. The difference between the two, as I'm going to highlight in my next article, is a pedophile is a diagnostic term. A child molester is a legal term. He's been adjudicated. He's been found guilty. He is just that. So if you drill that down, he's no different than, you know, the Chester the molester that's, you know, using a snorkel at the pool looking at little kids. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not glamorous because he was some football coach. It's as disgusting gets. Moreover, you have an entire agency with huge reach, right, that was condoning outsourcing a lot of the, what we'll call the, you know, central protection services or child protective services that were putting these children in harm's way. How do you explain, as an example you brought up, Matt Sandusky, who was adopted at 18? He was an adult. In 1994-1995, he burned a barn. Now, by the way, he was, I'm going to say, about 15 in that time frame.
Right.
Jerry Sandusky, he's accusing Jerry now of beginning to molest him at the age of 8. So I ask you, at the time that his separation, his removal from his birth family, and he's put into the Sandusky home, his brother calls the home, Dottie Sandusky answers the phone, and she says, "You can't talk to him because he's not your brother anymore." Oh, hangs up.
Jeez.
Then he burns a barn. Then he, a year after that, around give or take, he tries to commit suicide with another female relative living in the Sandusky home in a hotel room. And a judge decides that he should still remain in the Sandusky home. My point in telling you this is, did this child burn a barn and try to kill himself to get away from this abuse? Of course he did.
Sure he did, yep.
Of course he did. Does anybody understand the magnitude of a child burning a structure so that he gets arrested and put into juvenile detention as opposed to living in the Sandusky home and nobody did anything? In fact, Judge Grine, who we'll tie this back into Ray Grecar, if you remember, is still the missing prosecutor out of Center County. Presumed deceased, actually declared deceased about a year ago now.
Right.
He was very close with him. He is a judge that determined Sandusky, Matt Sandusky, was still better off with the Sandusky family, although he burned something, went to juvenile detention, and he tried to commit suicide.
Yeah.
The problem is, this is a criminal matter, potential criminal matter, up and down the food chain. In a small community that absolutely believed that it was untouchable. Right now, with all the civil suits pending, the judges are literally like standing in line recusing themselves in that community because they don't want to hear the cases, because guess what? Everybody's background is going to be evaluated, and they're tied to Penn State, they're tied to Grine, they're tied to Sandusky, they're tied to the Second Mile. They're going to be, you know, bussing in judges from other states to hear civil matters because it's that much of a mess.
Yep.
At the end, here's what I want to know. I want to know how this man abused, and if there's 8 victims, Dana, there's 100.
Sure there is, yep.
How did he go undetected and uncaught since 1977? And what is the legacy that put him into the monster chair that he sits in? Because I promise you, he has a legacy. He was a victim of abuse. We know this. We know this.
Yep.
There are several paraphilias that he exhibited, whether that was telephone calls. You know, I can give you all the profile names for this, but at the end of the day, it is just unbelievable that he was not caught. People knew it. People gossiped about it. He didn't get jobs because of it, but nobody, you know, 3 grand juries convened and nobody indicted. Why?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big story and one that's far from over. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We got about 5 minutes. This is not the end of this story as far as blankoncrime.com goes. And, again, I ask you this all the time. How do you keep up? This is not something you just sit down for 5 minutes and type up and then go and watch a soap opera or something. That and all the other stories that you're working on, it's funny that better life or the better half of your life isn't kicking you out to the curb, you and your computer.
Well, I will tell you this. You know, it can be stressful. And to add insult to injury, with my children that are home, you know, for the summer, mom is actually in summer school because I was waitlisted for some graduate courses, and it opened up, but I had to take them all at the same time.
Right.
So in the last 3 weeks, I've got a full caseload on top of it. Course load on top of my caseload.
Yeah.
But to your question, it happens to be in a lateral area of study. One is the motivation of the sexual offender with specificity towards pedophilia, paraphilias. So in a way, you almost look at, the stars are dictating what you're supposed to be doing and learning, because as I'm learning what I'll call the more advanced scope of this while this is going on, the level of understanding and fear that I'm faced with as I'm learning this tells me just how really serious this is.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I'm thankful for that. But on the other side, I do have to dial it back a bit, and I expect to do that. It's like everything's hitting at once.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to say sometimes when we have readers that are like, when are you going to update this and when are you going to update that? I wish I could cover, every story. I wish I could update it. I'm thankful to the readers and contributors that, Dana, sometimes my site's like a little bit of a research lab.
I know.
they're like, hey, I'll post something, and I'm so fascinated and thankful for those readers that are advocates, because that's what it all comes down to. Nobody really feels like they have a choice. It's like, this is just wrong, so how do I contribute?
Yeah.
But, fortunately, we have a lot of support in the area of what I do, and, it takes that to be able to do it. So, to that, plus, he's a lucky man. And he knows it.
Yeah, there you go. Well, my dear, you're doing a hell of a job. And again, Blink from blinkoncrime.com. Go there to learn everything about anything and all these stories, Sandusky included. The update will be in the next couple of days?
It will.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to reading it myself. Thank you, ma'am. Talk soon.
Oh, my best to you. Be well, Dana.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
That's Blink from Blink on Crime. How she does it is beyond me. How they do it over at Scared Monkeys is beyond me. I do a show once a week, and it's hard to keep up with that sometimes, but these guys are going 24/7. Doing something that mainstream media doesn't do is giving you the whole story and nothing but the story. That's it. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure and pick up the book, The Charmer. Click on the link in the show notes. Check out blinkoncrime.com, and don't forget us here at scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.